Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, GOP nominee Donald Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan sat down for a meeting that the media has been hyping as something on the level of the Yalta Conference, if the Yalta Conference was about domesticating an insane, doll-handed white supremacist. But unifying the party won't be easy. There remains a subset of conservatives that have not given up on stopping Trump's ascension. Joining us to talk about what the Never Trump movement plans to do now is one of its chief organizers, Republican consultant Liz Mayer. Meanwhile, North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory, in his quest to demonize transgendered residents of the Tar Heel State, has entered a new stage, one in which the federal government threatens to withhold money from the state on the grounds that they've, you know, enshrined unconstitutional discrimination as a state practice, and the state has answered back with a legal claim of their own. So, who is suing who, and why, and how, and good Lord, why is this happening, and has everyone forgotten it's 2016, we're all supposed to be adults for Pete's sake, are just some of the questions that we will attempt to answer. Finally, the Federal Reserve. For many, it's an institution that brings order out of chaos and helps our world thrum along effectively. For others, it's a famously opaque institution whose mysteries should be prized open for the public to see. But how did this institution come to be created? Well, rejoice, bank dorks. We'll talk with Roger Lowenstein, whose book, America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve, takes us back in time to chronicle the epic struggle to create the Federal Reserve. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Laura Barone Lopez, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Dana Liebelson. And here's what happened first. Hello, everybody who listens to So That Happened. Welcome back to another edition of our podcast about misanthropy and politics and the great yawning despair that is our times. My name is Jason Linkins. I'm the editor of Eat the Press. Joining me this morning, we're going to talk about a lot of things, but joining me this morning, we're going to get into some hot Donald Trump, Paul Ryan one-on-one action. Joining me, got Zach Carter.
Hey, everybody.
And it's been a while, but we're very, very happy to have back our stylish friend, Laura Barone Lopez.
Thanks for having me.
There was sort of a suggestion last week that there might be, I don't know, a tiny bit of friction between Donald Trump, who is the presumed nominee of the GOP, and Paul Ryan, who is the presumed guy everyone in the GOP wishes was the presumed GOP nominee.
Mm-hmm.
And this week they met to decide, I guess, that they're going to stay together for the kids.
Yeah, pretty much. To decide if they were going to be unified or not.
Right. And I guess
Paul and Trump fall together.
I guess the idea is that we're looking for Paul Ryan to sort of signal his endorsement
yes.
of Donald Trump. So
Which didn't happen.
What?
No, he's like getting warmer. They said that they talked about the few differences that they have when they met at the Republican National Committee with the RNC chairman.
Reince Priebus. Super genius, Reince Priebus,
I think
we have to call him.
And the rest of the House Republicans. And afterwards, Paul Ryan said that, you know, Trump has a great personality, seems like a genuine person. Anyone is better than Hillary Clinton. So he definitely cooled off on what he was saying a week ago. But when asked directly if he would endorse him before the convention, he dodged it. He wouldn't say.
I loved the line he said, you know, this is a process. And the thing is,
it takes time.
It's usually not a process.
No, it's not.
Usually, yeah. If you're the leader of Republicans in the House of Representatives, you don't have a problem endorsing the Republican candidate for president. It's just something that happens.
Yeah, it's reflexive.
And yet, even Paul Ryan appears to be embarrassed by the fascist takeover of the Republican Party.
What really, I think everyone in the office laughed when he said this, but he compared the so-called process that he's going through with Donald Trump, which is like, oh, I'd like to get to know you better. You know, I hear a lot of things like maybe you're an autocrat that thinks Mexicans are garbage. I don't know. I mean, it's cool. It's like a first date. We can get to some of this other sort of, other stuff out later.
Yeah, by the way, if you're just talking about what a great personality your date had after the first date, it probably didn't go that well. Exactly. It's usually how it happens.
Seriously. But he said he compared it directly to like the process of he and Mitt Romney coming together.
Yeah, nope.
And everyone laughed. And we were like, come on, you can't. Me and Mitt Romney didn't agree on everything. Yeah, but you didn't like have, you didn't have people standing around wondering, God, are these two guys going to get along?
Once. Did he say, I can't endorse Mitt Romney at this point in time?
Right. So. Right.
And if he had, do we really think that Paul Ryan is going to be the vice president for Donald Trump? Do we think that?
No.
I don't.
We don't think that. Like, that would be crazy. But, I mean, what am I going to say? Am I going to start saying that crazy things won't happen in this election now? See where that got me.
I got to say, as awful and frightening as the Trump candidacy has been, the silver lining has been watching all of these Republicans who have just done terrible things in years past just have to feel terrible and look awkward in public over and over again. I mean, it's not like Donald Trump is the first candidate to say nasty things about immigrants, right? Remember Mitt Romney's campaign platform. Campaign platform on immigration was self-deportation.
We're going to make things so bad that they want to leave.
That people leave. That's a nasty thing to do.
Mm-hmm, and that's what Democrats in both the House and Senate are talking about a lot right now, especially with Trump coming this week. They have had a number of press conferences just dedicated to Trump. But what they're doing is they're showing side by side, saying, look, it's Trump was birthed by Republicans in the House. They showed Representative Steve King talking about immigrants with, you know, calves the size of cantaloupes because they were bringing drugs over across the border.
Very strange that that was the one muscle group that drug smuggling allegedly worked.
Yes.
Very strange.
And, you know, they also showed clips of when Representative Peter King talked about saying that there were too many mosques in the country. So they were trying to show, look, this isn't the first time a Republican has said these things. And why is Paul Ryan acting so astonished by Trump and yet not calling out his own members?
Well, I think that he's astonished that someone who now says the quiet part loud is the presidential nominee.
Someone
who makes the subtext text.
I think that's part of it. I mean, I also think that the Republican establishment, the class of elites that we refer to as the Republican establishment, generally cares about two things. They care about an extremely hawkish foreign policy in which the United States drops bombs to solve as many problems as possible. And they also care about a supply-side economic set of principles in which we solve economic problems by cutting taxes for wealthy people. And it's really not clear that Donald Trump adheres to either of those. It's not clear what the hell Donald Trump adheres to in terms of policy. But I think what Paul Ryan, his goal in life here is to cut taxes for rich people and cut entitlement benefits for old people and poor people. And it's not clear that Donald Trump agrees with either of those things. It's not clear that he doesn't agree with them.
Those are the things that they need to patch up. It's like, so I like the cut of your jib, but really, are you going to cut entitlements? Because he has consistently said
Ryan didn't. Ryan did not care about the racist stuff that Mitt Romney was saying in 2012 because Mitt Romney agreed with him on these economic policies. And I find it hard to believe that all of these Republicans who are now crying foul about Trump's bigotry really only care about the bigotry, given what the party has been doing for the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Are we getting closer to a Trump that's going to be more supply-side oriented? I mean, we learned this week he's breaking bread with supply-siders to develop a tax plan, I guess a tax plan that he'll now stick to and say is my plan. But that's.
I mean, look, Donald Trump has already put forward a tax plan that the Conservative Tax Foundation said would cost at least $10 trillion.
Sure, but it's going to be like $6 trillion now.
To put that in context, the national debt owed to the public is like $12 trillion. So he's basically talking about doubling the national debt. I mean, like this is, you know, the idea that he's going to like break bread with conservatives.
They don't care about the debt. We know that. It's
always been a shadow boxing move in order to cut entitlements. People scream about the deficit and the debt because what they really want to do is make sure that old people don't have as much stuff. And that's really all it is. The debt, you know, if we cared about the debt, we would not have gone into Iraq. We would not have done the Bush tax cuts. We would not have done many things.
Is there a general mood up on Capitol Hill with all these proceedings going on? Because it's so unusual. Mm-hmm. This pairing of Ryan and Trump, it feels like a couple that's simultaneously going out on their first and second date and divorcing and dividing up assets.
Yes.
It's so perplexing.
Among House Republicans, it is an interesting, I mean, all Republicans on the Hill, it's interesting to watch them whenever they're asked a Trump question, especially if they, you know, haven't indicated that they would endorse him yet or not, or are overly supportive of him. You know, the funny thing is that they just like to call him the nominee. They don't even want to mention his name if they can help it. And every time they're asked a question about him, and even when they were asked questions about Cruz, you know, it was a little smirk and a kind of like shift. And then, we're going to support whoever the nominee is, and I think that we're having a great campaign, and
it's been a great party, and
anyone's better than Hillary, so I think we're headed in the right direction.
The truth is, not anyone is better than Hillary. Just not true. A lot of Bernie Sanders supporters out there who have been saying that too, and they are wrong.
I guess we'll continue to watch this unfold as if it was a season of The Bachelor.
Sounds like a good plan.
We may have to have a podcast where we just give Claire and Emma the opportunity to hold forth on Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan said that Donald Trump had a warm personality.
Right, yeah.
He said that.
Claire Fallon and Emma Gray, if you're out there listening, please, we'd like to borrow your insight into The Bachelor in adjudicating the Ryan-Trump relationship. Okay, Zach Carter, Laura Barrón-López, I appreciate you guys so much. It's just so great having you here. And
it's great to be here.
Yeah, it's really great. It's fantastic. And we have a great show. Please stick around. We will be right back.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Joining us, very special guest to kick things off. She is a Republican consultant. She has consulted most recently, I believe, with Scott Walker's presidential campaign.
That is technically correct.
He might still be a presidential candidate if he hadn't cashiered you. Now she is the Khaleesi of the Never Trump movement. Please welcome Liz Mayer.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have you, Liz Mayer, even though I think this is the first time you've actually been on the podcast. But
I've been on other things.
You've been on other things here at the Huffington Post. Glad to talk to you. And so we're going to talk about right now the future of the hashtag Never Trump movement.
Sure.
Today you've outlined... Sorry, I said today, Arthur.
Yeah, we're not on a day right now, dear listener. It's whenever you are.
So this week, you've taken up the cause of like trying to find a path forward for Republicans who are really, really upset that Donald Trump is their nominee, options that they have going forward into the election. Because right now there's no real primary option because there's no real primary opponent anymore.
Yeah. Or, well, I mean, I think if you look at Nebraska's results last night, there are obviously still about 40% of the voters in some states that refuse to accept that position.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know. To some extent, maybe there is an option. Maybe there's not. But yeah, basically, I wrote this piece in The Federalist largely because I've been getting a lot of questions from everybody from average Americans who are friends of mine, who follow what I do, to reporters, to fellow activists about, okay, well, now that Trump is apparently the last candidate standing, what's Never Trump going to do? And I kind of reached the point where I thought, okay, I can spend 4 hours a day doing interviews talking about this and saying the same thing over and over again, or I can write the piece.
Right. And still do interviews.
And still do interviews, right? Yes.
Yes, you'll never...
And still clog up my time, no, which is all good.
Never skip our clutches.
That's right. No, it's so all good. But here we're talking beyond what's the basic stuff that's in the piece. So, I mean, people should go and take a look at it. But basically, the point of the piece, I'm not personally committing myself to anything beyond not voting for either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, which is basically the position that I've had for, oh, I don't know, basically since both of them were obviously going to be in the race.
But as some Republicans are going to vote for Hillary Clinton, or
yes,
so they have said.
So they have said. Yeah, I think, and I do think that that's real for a lot of people. I have sat in meetings with fellow Never Trump activists where I have been sort of hated on for, you know, drawing any sort of equivalency between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, as I'm sure some people listening to this podcast will share. But yeah, I think that that is real for those people. You know, when I've said to people that fundamentally a lot of the objections that I have to Donald Trump are the same objections that I have to Hillary Clinton, I'm a libertarian, so I have a very minority view on a lot of these things. People who I think are more mainline conservatives, they have in some cases objected to that and said, no, I think she would be better. I will vote for her. And so I guess those people aren't really actively part of the Never Trump movement anymore, because a lot of what Never Trump is focused on, as this piece outlines, is trying to find some option that doesn't entail Clinton or Trump for people who are not exclusively Republican voters who are disenchanted with the setup. But at this point, predominantly, I think at some point you may see certain types of Sanders voters potentially taking a look at those options, depending on what those options are. But, you know, one of them that I think potentially could be attractive to some Sanders voters is the first one that I lay out, which is supporting the Libertarian Party nominee, particularly if that's Gary Johnson, because in him you're going to be dealing with somebody who is socially more moderate to liberal. But, you know, when you're looking at Sanders voters who maybe are socially more moderate to liberal but are primarily voting on the issue of civil liberties or foreign policy record, they may not be comfortable with Hillary Clinton. And so somebody like Gary Johnson, I think, could potentially be appealing there.
I wrote about Gary Johnson just yesterday. He actually is quite an appealing candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Begin with the fact that he's one of the more fundamentally decent human beings to ever lace it up and want to run for president.
Right.
I think he's definitely squarely in your wheelhouse, Liz, on immigration. He's not some kind of like xenophobic.
No, I think I will cop to being not 100% familiar with every single thing he's ever said on every single issue. But my general sense is that he sees immigration as a net positive, not a net negative, which is true of many people in the Republican Party, too. But it doesn't appear to be true of Donald Trump, at least in his current iteration. You know, I would stipulate current, because obviously he's been all over the map on a range of issues,
sure,
including immigration.
Should his future iterations matter? I'm amazed that people are waiting to see what he does, as if that will affect their thinking.
Well, to me, it doesn't much matter. I mean, my problem with Donald Trump, if we get down to it, is it's really to do with his issue positions on a couple of matters where he has been consistent, actually, over the last 30 years, and he's not saying anything different now. And this is where I may have some disagreements with people who are listening to this podcast. But if you look at Donald Trump's comments on healthcare over decades now, okay, now he's kind of trying to sound a little bit more conservative friendly, largely by saying, I hate Obamacare. Okay, well, on spec, I mean, I guess there are a lot of conservatives that are like, yeah, I do too. But the difficulty with Trump on that for me is, sure, he doesn't like Obamacare. That's because he likes single-payer health care and because he likes socialized health care systems. And if you look at his stance on health care policy over about 30 years, he has been very consistent. He has been for single-payer. He said good things about the Canadian system. He said good things about the British system and the Scottish system in particular, which is arguably worse than what you find in a lot of the rest of the UK. And so for me, I mean, whatever he wants to say on health care going forward is really pretty irrelevant because he has a decades-long history of taking those positions.
So you've got to drill down on things that have been there from before.
Right. And that's one of them. Another one is, you know, his view with regard to trade policy and tariffs and wanting to do things that would entail instigating trade wars with people. And he's been remarkably consistent about that, too.
That's true, yeah.
You know, he really has. Is somebody who comes from Washington State, comes from Seattle. It's an economy that tends to do very well out of trade. My family is Scottish. Scots really wouldn't have a lot going for us as a group were it not for the ability to move around the world and conduct trade and commerce. I don't really agree with him when it comes to trade policy at all either, but he has been remarkably consistent about that. I think also when you look at sort of his overall view, to the extent that you can really call it a view on foreign policy, certainly when you look at specifics, you know, he said, oh, I always opposed the Iraq war. Like, obviously, that's not true.
Such a liar.
There are a number of things where, on the specifics, he is fibbing, to put it mildly. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know.
So Gary Johnson,
yes. Gary Johnson obviously doesn't have quite that view, I think, when it comes to foreign policy either. But I think when we look at questions regarding things like civil liberties that unfortunately do tie in with foreign policy at this point in time, I think that he is probably a more rational candidate on those sorts of topics.
Like not rounding up 11 million people.
I think also his views on things like surveillance of one's emails or phone calls are probably a little bit more in keeping with the American tradition than perhaps what I would say either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump's have been.
I think that's fair to say.
And I think that, you know, going back to my original point, I think for that reason, I mean, he is interesting to a lot of Republicans who are pissed off at Donald Trump and don't want to support him because the Libertarian Party's performance means that very likely he is going to be on all state ballots. So it's an easy option if he gets a nomination to tick the box. But I think beyond that, he is going to be interesting to some Sanders voters for those civil libertarian reasons as well.
But so, voting for him would help Hillary Clinton.
Depends on the state. And I'm not sure actually that that's going to be true in the round. I think a lot of people say that. To be honest, I think given the way that Donald Trump might perform in the general election, nobody needs to be helping Hillary Clinton or will be helping
matter.
Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so there's that. But I think also, you know, just generally when we get into talking about third party candidacies and who they help and who they hinder, I mean, yes, probably in some states that may help Hillary and in some states that may help Trump.
So that's
but in the round, you know, you go back and you look at Ross Perot and there's this great mythology out there that Ross Perot running deprived George H.W. Bush of a second term. And that's actually not true.
So that's a seamless mechanism that Republicans who don't want to vote for Trump can move into. There's a trickier one that you've talked about, though, and that is this idea that you find conservatives who are of, I would say, important standing within certain states to run solo campaigns in those ballots.
And that's and the reason
Mitt Romney runs in Utah, wins Utah, deprives Trump of those electoral votes.
Right. This is sort of called the independent conservative option. And it's something that I think, to be fair, is probably of greater interest to never Trump folks than voting for Gary Johnson. It just may not be as practical depending on how things play out. Anyway, getting back to where we started with this. This is one reason that the independent conservative bid has appeal. There is the thought that for those people who simply cannot support candidates that they know are going to be on the ballot, they could support, I don't know, let's say if hypothetically if Paul Ryan said, okay, fine, throw my name in the mix, I'll run in all 50 states, right?
Yeah,
people would be comfortable with that. And the idea is that if you pick the right person or the right people to run in different states, there are people like me who maybe aren't voting on something like abortion as an issue, but for other reasons, or potentially a little bit that reason, are deeply concerned about Clinton and Trump. those people would probably vote for that kind of a candidate, too. And that's true. I mean, candidly, if Paul Ryan were on my presidential ballot, I would tick his name in a heartbeat. I don't think I would think twice about it. The question is, who do you find to do that? And can you find one person that you can run in all 50 states? Or do you need to do the thing that, I detail in more specificity, which is finding extremely well-known, popular, liked people with high name ID from individual states and putting those people on the ballot? So, yeah, somebody like Mitt Romney in Utah, like, I don't know, Susan Collins in Maine.
That sounds really
Olympia
hard.
Snow.
You should steal the delegates.
That's another option, is trying to just go to the delegates. And this is something that Eric Erickson, who is another person who is prominently never Trump, basically has urged. And I think it was put up on his website, The Resurgent. I know we're not doing days, but sort of
this week.
Sort of kind of
this
like
week.
Yesterday or today or sometime recently. You can go to The Resurgent and do a little bit of searching, and you will find a post that basically advocates for Republican delegates not participating in what Erickson calls sort of a suicide pact, and essentially going to the convention, throwing out the rule book, and doing whatever they want.
The dirty secret about right. political conventions is that they are essentially Calvin Ball. You could just make up the rules.
I mean, yeah, the thing that you know, Donald Trump has been sort of bleeding on about is that political parties ultimately are kind of self-governing organizations, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in the same way that the Trump organization can do whatever he wants, so can Republican delegates.
There's always the ramifications you have to live with afterwards.
Right.
But of course, I guess, to your mind, you're weighing those ramifications against the ramifications of Donald Trump becoming president.
Or maybe not even becoming president, but just tainting the party and causing massive down-ballot losses, right? I mean, that's one of the things that I think people are really concerned about, and one of the things that is, again, a strong driver towards the independent conservative option or the just getting the delegates to throw the rule book out option really is trying to save people who are down-ballot. There is a very deep concern that nominating Trump probably means we just automatically handed the presidency to Hillary Clinton. I wouldn't say that that's a 100% cert, but I certainly see a lot of data that indicates that that is an overwhelming probability as it stands. Right. I think the big concern is, so then what happens with Senate and House races? We may be able to stomach the idea of losing the presidency. Republicans have got pretty used to that recently. but the idea of losing certain senators and losing the House is one that's very hard for people to stomach. And so that's one of those reasons why those options has attraction, has appeal.
All right, Liz Mayer. You can follow her on Twitter, at Liz Mayer, LizMayr.
That's right.
Her piece is at The Federalist today. Please check that out. We'll include a link to it somehow, some way.
Today or not today or this week or sometime this month.
It happened at a moment in time.
At some point, yes.
And time is a flat circle, fleeting in the end. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'd love to have you back. All right, we will be right back. And we're back. And right now we're back with Zach Carter. You're here.
Hello. Hello.
Hey there, Zach. And joining us is our wonderful colleague, Dana Liebelson.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've had you on the show.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Because you won't come on the show.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm happy to be here now.
But we got you. We got you now.
By the way, Dana just was a finalist for Big Journalism
Award.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about that
thanks,
briefly.
Guys.
We want to congratulate Dana for being a big finalist for what award was it?
It's the Livingston Award, which is for young people.
Journalists
under 35.
It's a pretty big deal. So
congratulations.
Thanks.
Congratulations. Dave Jameson, also a big winner of Journalist
Yeah,
prizes.
Deadline Award.
Yeah, so everything, you know, real pedigree is what we're promising you here on this podcast. So, okay, in North Carolina, Governor Pat McCrory invented a crime to then criminalize it, the crime being transgendered people couldn't walk into restrooms unless they were the ones that were on their birth certificate. And it's been a big mess. Now the state of North Carolina is suing the federal government. The federal government is suing the state of North Carolina. We're going to try to make sense of some of this. It is so hard, Dana, for me to talk about this law in general because it is the kind of law that a shitty 7-year-old kid would come up with.
Yeah, I have to agree that the logic behind it is incredibly bizarre. I think, you know, the conservative line of thinking is that we don't want male predators going into public restrooms and attacking women and children.
None of us want that.
Which, first of all, that's a crime. And second of all, there's been a number of domestic violence and sexual assault prevention groups that have come out and said, what are you even talking about? This has nothing to do with victims of abuse.
Right.
And, you know, that's why critics of the law argue that, in fact, it's very much designed to just be discriminatory against transgender individuals.
Right. And the actual, I think, seed event behind this was didn't have anything to do with a crime. There's no crime wave of transgendered people assaulting people in bathrooms. If anything, it's the reverse. But the precipitating event seems to have been Charlotte, North Carolina, passing a broad ordinance protecting all kinds of people against discrimination, including transgendered people. And Pat McCrory had a problem with that and shut it down with this bill.
Yeah, it was a pretty standard civil rights ordinance. And then out of that, we got this incredibly strange, sort of unprecedented law. The thing that drives me crazy here is, like, do we really think that criminals read bathroom signs before going to attack women?
Sure, sure.
Like, is that the logic here?
Of course, like, they do. It's like, oh, crap.
If I'm carrying around a sign that says, don't harass me, do you think men on the street are listening, like, going to read my sign? I'm sorry. This is my own tangent about this.
Let's just talk about enforcing this law for a second here. How is it that you prove that you're not transgender before you go into the bathroom? Is there an inspector? What is the process here?
I feel like almost this entire conversation is offensive to, I mean, it's offensive and it's offensive to the transgender community because, you know, you shouldn't require people to prove, you know, their gender identity.
And if anything, it just doesn't make sense to me because now you have people walking into bathrooms if they're following the law. And saying, hey, there's a reason I look like a dude and I'm standing in the women's bathroom, which just draws more attention to it. Logic is so out of whack here. It's almost intention with anyone who has an intellect. And I think that's kind of what the federal government's position on this is.
Yeah, to kind of make this even more absurd to taxpayers. So, you know, the federal government wrote a letter to the governor saying, hey, this law violates federal civil rights law, as well as the Violence Against Women's Act. You should fix this in the next week. And rather than sort of addressing potential discrimination issues, the governor sued the feds back. And he basically wants the federal court to clarify that, no, this law is not discriminatory under federal law. And what's at stake here is a huge amount of federal funding. And we're talking, you know, up to $4.7 billion right. in education funds, as well as about $5 million in funds that go to anti-domestic violence programs. And this is all under the Violence Against Women Act. So, you know, you could argue that maybe the federal government shouldn't be holding these funds hostage, but you could also argue, why is the governor risking these funds to defend this law that's, like, not very popular and is throwing businesses out of the state?
It's kind of an amazing conservative coup, though. If he loses the case, then less education funding and less funding for violence against women programs.
Right. So,
if he wins,
more bathroom laws.
One of the parts of McCrory's response to the government's action was just priceless. It's like, ugh. The chutzpah on this dipshit. He complained that he wasn't given enough time to respond to their brief. And we're talking about a guy who passed a law in a one-day special session
right.
of the state legislature where people didn't get a chance to adequately read what was happening
right.
until it was too late. We didn't even get reporting out of this on this bill and what it was going to do until it had passed. And for the guy to complain about, oh, I haven't had enough time, this is a real rush, it's just, he's an amazingly ballsy dipshit. But you've also talked about how people who are in the business of trying to protect prevent domestic violence and protect survivors have said that this law is going to completely screw up their lives, too.
I don't know if they've phrased it that way. I mean, with the funding.
Yeah.
I mean, if this funding was stripped, and this could take a long time because, you know, the case could be appealed to the Supreme Court. It could take years. It would absolutely affect how they're providing services and affect victims and outreach and education. I don't think anyone wants it to get to that point.
And I
don't think it will. But I think the fact that the governor is willing to risk it is sort of interesting in and of itself.
Well, like you said,
be perfectly within his policy brief to deny domestic violence funding to the people of the state.
Yeah, yeah. No, McCrory's been a really hardline right-winger, sort of in the mold of maybe not Scott Walker, but Sam Brownback in Kansas. Despite the fact that he's from a state that is not as conservative as it used to be. I mean, you can even look among among self-identified Republicans in North Carolina. I think only like 48%, 52%. There's an almost even split of Republicans who support the bathroom law. So it's a very, very, I mean, he's representing a conservative wing of a Republican Party that does not, is clearly pushing back against the direction in which the state has been moving over the last decade. And it's interesting to me to see it get more reactionary, because we've sort of seen that in other parts of the country, too. And I think the country overall, particularly on social issues, you see the country becoming more liberal. And as a result, I mean, we didn't need to have bathroom laws 20 years ago, right?
I'm sure there were still kind of a panic about bathrooms.
But all of these people who are freaking out about trans people right now, it's not like they were really comfortable with trans people 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But they didn't feel the need to just have a law just being like, by the way, we want to make it official. We don't like those people. Just so you guys know, okay? And now there's this backlash. And to me, it's sort of like, I think culturally, it's the sort of last gasp. These things are not, even if this law ends up being upheld and all of this, you know, state funding goes away, it's not like they're really going to be enforcing this law in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years.
I think it's crazy. I think anything goes wrong in North Carolina, crime-wise, the mantra has to be get out of the bathrooms and start actually arresting people who actually commit crimes, though this made-up nonsense. It's important to point out that there is actually kind of a split and backlash within North Carolina's government, too, because this lawsuit that McCrory is filing, it's being filed through means other than the Attorney General's office, because the Attorney General is a Democrat who's actually gunning for McCrory's seat.
Yeah, Roy Cooper is running against the governor this year for the seat. And I think McCrory didn't even tell Cooper that he was filing the lawsuit in advance, which I found fairly hilarious.
I mean,
because, you know, that's technically the state's top attorney. And he was like, and that just shows that's not so uncommon. I mean, Cooper's made it really clear he's not defending this law, and
he's been pretty outspoken against it.
Yeah, and we saw that happen a lot with, all the same-sex marriage cases statewide. There were a lot of attorneys general who recused themselves from these cases because they felt like these, you know, anti-gay marriage laws were unconstitutional. So that's kind of
and
just
you really,
what we're
especially
seeing
if you're
here.
A high-profile elected official and lawyer, you really don't want to be looking back in 20 or 30 years and be like, okay, son, so that thing that I defended back then, because it's pretty obvious where the country's gone.
Yeah, I mean, we saw how same-sex marriage went, so.
So, yeah, it does feel like a last gasp, but what a brutal thing to do to people who have never really, who've always been just really, really marginalized on our society. This is one of the least deserving groups of people to kick in the teeth
now. Just don't be assholes. That's just the general rule. Don't be an asshole.
Okay.
This law is being an asshole.
We should all take time and reflect on whether we are assholes in our lives and make changes. All right. Cool.
Thanks, guys.
We've established at least one good thing we can go going forward. Zach, thanks for being here. Dana, thanks for being here.
Thanks
for
guys.
Using the proper plural of Attorney General. It's no wonder you win big awards all the time. We're really happy to have you on the show, and we'll love to have you
more
back.
More Dana's Liebelson.
In another 3 months when you decide to come back on the show. But we'll always be here.
Okay, thanks.
All right, we'll be right back.
And we're back. Never fear, podcast listeners. I know it's a little uncomfortable for me to be hosting this right now instead of Jason Lincolns.
It's not true.
But I'm Zach Carter. I'm here with Jason Lincolns.
Hi.
And we have a very special guest right now, a man who has written a book called America's Bank, which is about the birth of the Federal Reserve. And his name is Roger Lowenstein. Roger, thanks for joining us.
Gentlemen, it's a real pleasure.
So, Roger, you wrote a book. I mean, I'm a bank dork, so I like this type of thing, and I just find it inherently interesting. But why write a book about the birth of the Federal Reserve, something that happened over a century ago now?
Well, it happened in this, to me anyway, fascinating period in the middle of the progressive movement, but in progressive era, but also in a time when people were so upset about a lot of the things we're upset about now. People were upset about big banks. They were upset about financial crashes and potential for bailouts. They were upset about what level of government or not should be involved in the economy. And, you know, when I started this book, it was right after, in the aftermath of our most recent disaster with mortgages and bailouts and everything. And when the Fed was so involved, and the Fed is so involved, and I wanted to know how we came through a somewhat similar crash a century ago without a Fed, and why it was that we didn't have one, because even at that time, we were the only nation in the developed world that was trying to run their economy on this extreme laissez-faire basis with, you know, no lender of last resort. And the answers just all flowed right to the debates we're having today. So for me, you know, and hopefully people out there, bank dorks or not, it was just a fascinating topic.
So I found some of the historical details about the economic world before the Fed to be really basically unsettling, because we kind of take for granted that that there is like one uniform American currency, but that really wasn't the case before the Federal Reserve, was it?
We had individual banks, private banks that were chartered by the states. They were in, that is, the states gave them a charter permitting them to do banking, and they would lend money to people. Those that where they would borrow money. Mm-hmm. Those borrowings took the form of notes. So it'd be a piece of paper, a note, an IOU from the Chase Bank of New York, say, or somebody bank in Delaware, and that note would pass around as though it were currency. And people would occasionally go back to the bank and say, this note's okay, but I'm doing gold or silver, and the bank would either say, here you go, sir. Or they'd say, let's come back in a week or two. So when people carry these notes around to the store or to the iron furnace or wherever they were doing business, sometimes if they were offered a note from this, say, bank in Pittsburgh or someplace in Ohio or West Virginia or someplace further west, they would say, this note is a note for $100, but I'm going to take it for 90 cents because I don't really know that bank so well. Or maybe I'll take it for 70 cents. It was called discounting. So each piece of paper was scrutinized for, not only what it said on the face it was worth, but the potential that there was really gold or some sort of a security behind it.
That's truly insane. This period, not just economically, but politically, was fascinating. Your book tracks kind of the transition between Teddy Roosevelt's administration through the Taft administration to Woodrow Wilson, and the process of putting together the Fed. It was a few guys with ideas, a few guys with power, a lot of skepticism, and a nation in a deep hangover from a pair of really serious banking crises. What could you just set the scene for us politically?
Yeah, so the scene politically, today, the political parties were in transition. If you go back to the 19th century, Democrats were the party of farmers, Westerners, and most assuredly Southerners. What we people of my generation called Dixiecrats, George Wallace Democrats, small government people. They were the party of Jefferson, of Jackson. The Republicans were still the party of Lincoln. They were the more, what we would today call, more liberal. They were also the party of the East Coast, the bankers, big business. But this was beginning to shift. And as the progressive movement gained sway, and the progressive movement was for things like settlement houses for poor people, a better treatment of immigrants, public education for everybody, a more fair primary system, sort of reforms that made the country more democratic, slightly more egalitarian, not just a society of plutocrats. And the progressive movement really threw a loop into the heretofore stable party arrangements, much, by the way, the same way this campaign today is sort of protests about inequality and so on have thrown a ringer into, both of our traditional parties today.
Let's just dig into that a little bit, because, I mean, when you talk about the Democratic Party before Wilson being kind of conservative, laissez-faire on economic issues, Democratic Party clearly doesn't get religion on racial equality for several decades to come. But this idea that the Democrats are in some way, the party of big government. This is something that you hear as a conservative criticism today. But I think people generally who support the Democratic Party say that they like government solutions to certain types of problems. Is the Fed sort of an early break in that direction for the party?
Great question. And just to close the loop on your question, the early Democratic Party, who were their heroes? Well, the first hero was Thomas Jefferson. Government that governs least governs best. That was, governs least. That's the Democratic Party. So come the Fed, the reform movement, or come the reform movements for a Federal Reserve, for a central bank, that fight is led at first by the Republican Party. The Republican Party being more forward, more progressive, more Atlanticist, closer to Europe and, observing that England and Germany and France have central banks and so on. But as the parties begin to fissure and to break up, this is why I go into the elections and the drama of the campaigns and so on in the book, the Republican Party sort of becomes incapacitated. Mm-hmm. And it's left to the Democrats, who are also evolving and, happily, at least for the people who were crusaders for a central bank, they get a Democrat, but Wilson, who ascends to the White House really because the Republicans split, and Roosevelt did run a third party ticket, of course, well passed. He's a new enough Democrat to embrace this idea of reform.
So I guess when we talk about the Fed today, there you have people on, I think, the conventional right saying we need to audit the Fed. I think there are also progressives who want to see more democratic accountability for the Fed. But we still have political debates over whether the Federal Reserve is a progressive institution, a reactionary institution, what it means. I mean, I think Not to give away the end of your book, but you say that the creation of the Fed doesn't—
spoilers, the Fed was created.
it does get created, and then it changes after it gets created.
But just don't tell them that right afterwards there was something called World War One.
What is the right way to think about the Fed? Is this a progressive reform that progressive reformers implement, or is this a big scam that the bankers imposed on us to further their own power?
We had serious money shortages almost annually. We had real breaks every third year or so. We had serious depressions more than every decade. A guy came over from Germany. He's a hero of the book, a fellow named Paul Warburg. Immigrated to the U.S., joined his in-laws firm in New York, and became sort of an observer of and participant in the banking scene, but one who knew what it was like in Europe. He likened our banking system to a town in which there was no fire department, but in which each home had a little well in the back door.
I remember that anecdote.
Maybe if you had a little kitchen fire, it would work, but you get a three-alarm blaze, you don't have the benefit of coordination of reserves, of pooling of reserves, and so on.
Which allows the central bank to essentially put out the fire with more water. I mean, I guess my question is, you have this pooling of reserves that happens in 1913 with the creation of the Fed system, which makes it easier to put out certain types of financial crises. But I think when we talk about the financial system today and we talk about the Fed today, a lot of the way that we think about it is in terms of post-1913 reforms, things like deposit insurance, things like going off the gold standard. But in your book, you point out that these things were actually hotly debated at the time. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
There was deposit insurance in the Senate side of the legislation for the Federal Reserve. Ironically, Carter Glass, who was the head of the House Committee, wouldn't let it go through the House side. And I say ironically because Carter Glass, the one who put established the FDIC in Glass-Steagall 20 years later, but that was later.
That's right. He's the famous Glass from Glass-Steagall.
And the FDIC is the thing that, just for people out there, it's the thing that means that, like, if your bank fails, you don't lose all your money. You're fine. If a bank fails today and you have deposits there, you're fine, so long as you have less than $250,000 in that bank account.
Right. So the reason that worried people then and today, some too as well, particularly conservatives, is the idea that banks will be a little less cautious because depositors, you know, when you go to the bank today, commercial bank to deposit money, you don't worry so much about the bank's solvency because you know that the government stands behind you. So that's
tremendous
that
security.
Is a detriment. On the other hand, we haven't had commercial bank runs like we had back in the 19th century, or in fact in the Great Depression, and in the year I write about, people would run to the bank to get their money out because if you didn't get there in time, you didn't get it out.
Yeah, if you read Liaquat Ahmed in Lords of Finance, I mean, he basically says the gold standard is what causes the Great Depression. I mean, it's also what Milton Friedman says. But this is something that they were talking about in 1913.
That's what Barry Eichengreen said also in Golden Fetters. I mean, this is so that is a real break. And when I say a real break, I mean the people who I write about in 1913, whether people on the left or more conservative bankers, not one of them really could have envisioned fiat money, money that's just paper. They were very careful when they passed the Federal Reserve Act to make sure that we were still in the gold standard. The idea was if there's nothing behind the money, it's just going to turn to, confetti, and it'll be, terrible inflation and so on.
And particularly when you're a backwater nation, the way the United States was at the time, it's pretty risky to say, all right, just because we said so. But who are you? You're just this weird country.
This is something we're still debating today. It amazes me. It's a little off the subject of the book, but there are people who want to go back on the gold standard. Now, as you said, in the Ahmed's great book, Lords of Finance, about the Great Depression, and Milton Friedman, you're completely right, and many others have pointed out the gold standard didn't work in the 20s and 30s. Prices fell 30 years in a row, okay? 30 years of deflation. The Fed is freaking out right now because we might get like one quarter of deflation, okay?
And deflation, I mean, I think for most people who are listening to this, inflation is the thing that they're worried about. They're worried that their money won't be worth anything. But deflation is really, really bad for economies because it means anybody who's in debt just got way, way more in debt. And so it becomes impossible for not impossible, because much more difficult for the economy to function. And the idea that this was happening just as a standard practice in the United States for decades on end is I find that totally staggering.
It was insufferable. It wasn't working, and I know that Senator Cruz, the late candidate of the Republican Party of the president, wants to bring back the gold standard. I just urge people to
not do that.
Read about what it was like when we had it, because people weren't happy.
It was terrible.
Especially, by the way, particularly people from Cruz's part of the country, from the Southwest, from farm districts. They were showing up in Washington en masse with pitchforks to demand more money, silver money, greenback money, any kind of money, money back. Literally, this is the book, money back by grain receipts and warehouses.
Yeah.
But money back by gold didn't do it.
I think one of the things I found most interesting about your book is seeing the way different parties, people from different classes, people from different industries, people from different political parties come together to do something which clearly makes the country better. I guess I want to get, before we go here, get your thoughts on whether you think that type of reform is possible today.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think today, given the bipartisanship and cooperative spirit in Congress, I'm very optimistic that maybe they can agree on the new selections for the cafeteria in the Congress. But
all right. Well, thanks so much, Roger. It's really been great to have you. The book is called America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. It's by Roger Lowenstein. It's a great book. It's a fun read. And you can do it. You can probably read the book in as long as it took us to discuss it on this podcast. But so thanks for joining us, Roger. Appreciate your time.
It was fun. Bye-bye.
So that's what happened this week.
This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. This is the final So That Happened, executive produced by Caitlin Boguki, Khaleesi, mother of podcasts, who is on her way to the Gimlet Podcast Network. We want to thank Caitlin for helping us get our start and for shepherding the entire HuffPost podcast team into existence. We wish her all the best. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by author Roger Lowenstein, Republican consultant and anti-Trump organizer Liz Mayer, as well as Huffington Post reporters Laura Barone Lopez, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Dana Liebelson. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We miss you already.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.